Greetings, brothers and sisters. My name is Mbambulu, and the name of this broadcast is The Only Real Solution. You can check out my website at www.asetbooks.com. That's www.asetbooks.com. asetbooks.com. My email address is there also, as will be a copy of this radio broadcast. So if you miss a broadcast or want to repeat here, you can visit my website and listen 24/7 at your convenience. This broadcast, The Only Real Solution, is another edit of Mbambulu and Slide Over Productions. Hang on for a couple of minutes. I'll be right back.
You and me are bound to teach the others how to love one another. You and me are bound to teach the others how to love one another. You and me are bound to teach the others how to love one another. You and me are bound to teach the others how to love.
They call it only love and love what we have.
A lot of years ago, I did a radio interview with a good brother in Pittsburgh. I don't remember his name, and there have been so many industry changes since then that I doubt if he still has that radio show. He used to talk a lot about the United Snakes of America, and he wasn't pulling any punches. When you lay it on the line the way that brother did, and you're black in the good old U.S. of A., you normally end up with a tough road to hoe just to get by. Additionally, there is the threat of physical harm carried out by vigilante citizens,
John and Jane Doe,
police officers,
John and Jane Doe,
prosecutors,
John and Jane Doe,
and judges,
John and Jane Doe.
Fortunately, new Africans, like the brother in Pittsburgh, are not intimidated by the prospect of having to hold that tough role. I'm sure he knew he was going to be a target of John and Jane Doe, but that wasn't enough to cause him to sacrifice his principles and betray his DNA. He was a new African, and still is, I hope, a field nigger, as Malcolm X used to say. So he had the sense of justice, courage, and audacity to give it up straight and without a chaser. He was strong and knew that, being an intelligent new African, he could do what was necessary to provide the basics for himself and his dependents. I hope that good brother is still with us, but I know there are a lot more like him that are looking for the opportunity to start righting this situation we black people, we new Africans, have found ourselves in for so long. There are a lot of sisters and brothers who are itching to contribute their 2 cents worth, and some of them are listening to this broadcast. So let's get into you preparing yourself to effectively contribute your 2 cents worth to the creation of a new norm, a higher norm for new Africans who presently live in the United States of America. To take your new African reality to its logical conclusion, there are a number of stages you have to experience. As I stated earlier, you are not obligated to do anything after deciding to call yourself a new African. Declaring that you are a new African simply makes the world aware of the fact that you are a more informed and politically astute person than you used to be, and that in and of itself generates a more powerful wave when people see you and think about you. And I'm not talking about any make-believe stuff when I mention your wave. Our African ancestors knew thousands of years ago that life forms possess at least two natures, a physical nature and a wave nature. The physical nature is there for everyone to see, but the wave nature, though invisible to the human eye, is just as much there. People can't really put their finger on it, so they generally use a term like vibes to express a hard-to-explain feeling they have about a person. That, in part, is energy from your wave nature that they are picking up on. So it's important to be conscious of how your wave nature is affecting the way people respond to you. So, stage one is getting to the point where you feel comfortable referring to yourself as a new African. If you call yourself a new African but don't feel it, your wave nature will betray you. But if you feel it, that energy of self-appreciation, self-elevation, and racial pride is silently projected through your wave nature. It is an empowering experience, and being empowering, after you feel comfortable saying you are a new African, the next step is up to you. So, since step one is identifying yourself as a new African, step two then would hopefully be to found an independent black town or territory or become a citizen of an independent black territory or town that another new African or group of new Africans have already founded. However, there is quite a bit of wiggle space between step one and step two. Declaring yourself a new African does not mean you have to adopt a black nationalist posture. You can choose to keep on carrying out your life as you have been doing for the last 10 or 15 years. You don't have to change the way you dress or talk, or change the type of music you listen to. You don't have to change your spending habits, likes and dislikes, anything. If you want to, you can exhibit images or symbols of black pride in your home, on your property and surroundings, etc. Things like paintings, sculpture, flags, furnishings, black-centered images and literature, etc. But none of that is required. However, if your roots are in Africa and you are proud of your roots, even though you live in the United States, you should want to do a little bit more than simply develop a comfort zone with referring to yourself as a new African. In identifying yourself as a new African, you can continue to be the same United Stateser you were before. United Stateser is a term I sometimes use to refer to a citizen of the United States. John and Jane Doe call themselves Americans as if they are the only people in North, Central, and South America and the Caribbean that have the right to use that term in a citizenship context. But the fact of the matter is that most Americans are markedly different from those Americans who live in the United States. The Canadians don't call themselves Americans, but they live in North America and, along with the United Statesers, are just about the only pale-faced Americans in all of the Americas that I can think of. The overwhelming majority of Americans are people with a noticeable percentage of color in their skin. So John and Jane Doe's appropriation of the term American is more evidence of their lack of regard for people of color when the United States was in its infancy. They are actually just United Statesers, and I might start calling them that all of the time just to put them on the defensive. But back to the subject at hand. Some new Africans will not go beyond the stage one identification level, but other new Africans will. Those who will are the brothers and sisters that can help popularize black nationalist sentiments and hopefully become functioning and responsible citizens of the Republic of New Africa. There is a great deal of diversity in terms of what a new African can do as he or she navigates in and about the stage one new African level. Helping to popularize black nationalism is one activity, but nothing is set in stone as far as how popularizing black nationalism should be done. You can develop your own approach according to your communications comfort zone, or you can observe what others do and integrate some of their measures into a mode of operation for you. One thing, though, is helpful. The more you know, the more you will be able to accurately inform others. So get an understanding of black nationalism by way of whatever learning process is most agreeable to you. Some people prepare by doing a lot of reading and book studying. Others don't read that much but engage their friends, neighbors, strangers, and associates in meaningful conversations about black nationalism or subjects that are of interest or particular interest to black people. Other new Africans might be internet media types who learn and teach on social media platforms like YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, etc. Or it could be a combination of several methodologies. I'm old school and I distrust a lot of the social media environment, but serious black nationalists have to figure out an advantageous but secure way to make use of that platform. The objective, whatever the approach may be, is to make black nationalism a part of the new African mainstream conversation. The objective is to get the word on black nationalism out there and easily accessible. Let's reset a bit. First, you become comfortable representing yourself as a new African. Next, if you decide to take yourself farther into the mix, you begin to help in the process of popularizing black nationalism. That is, bringing it into the mainstream conversation, making it a part of Black people's mainstream conversation. Some new Africans are already involved in this process. Other new Africans are going to take in what they hear, but it will not inspire them to want to investigate and learn more on their own or as a result of their own initiative. As a consequence, their learning will remain on the fringes, but there is the possibility that they might become major contributors at a later stage in the process. Still, other new Africans who hear about this will want to know more and will engage themselves in a level of participation that is more organized than random. These persons might want to become part of a reading club or Black-centric study group, for example. All of these responses can represent a step toward a higher stage, but do not necessarily do so. That is because, like the first stage, all subsequent stages offer enough wiggle space and diversity that the new African can dive deeper into the mix and become either a more responsible participant in the new African struggle or, essentially, just a curious or scholarly observer. You would think those individuals who delve deeper into something would be more dedicated to its advancement, but that is not necessarily the case. Some people do things in order to better prepare themselves to advance the cause, while others do likewise for reasons that only they can explain. As a consequence, you have to be vigilant in order to decrease the chances that you will ally yourself with a person whose objectives are radically different from yours. Let's take a short break. I want to keep this simple because simplicity is where the fundamental elements are most easily recognized. People like to talk about how complex a situation is, but that is mostly rationalizing that tends to allow non-essentials to take on essential-like status. As a result, your ability to separate what is most important from what is less important is impaired. We're going to get bogged down if we fall into that trap. Don't go anywhere.
Bye.
Here is where we are in a nutshell. Some of us are going to identify themselves as new Africans. Out of these, some will stagnate and others will trend toward a deeper level of self-identification. Those who trend towards a deeper level of identification will follow diverse paths and demonstrate different levels of actualization and engagement. Those who delve deeper with the intent of lifting us up to where we should be, their actions and activities will, one way or the other, result in the emergence of a Republic of New Africa as an ideological linchpin and a physical reality. If you are Black, it is important to you, to your own self, to develop a comfort zone with calling yourself a New African. By doing so, you demonstrate that you are politically aware and astute enough to be accorded the status that viable and valued participants are generally accorded. Why settle for less when you can get more by simply declaring yourself a New African? I'm going to talk a little bit about history right now because we need to start taking control of the results when it comes to what happened to us, what's happening to us, and what will happen to us. We need to be strong. And we need strong-minded and strong-spirited New Africans at the forefront of our struggle. Those of us who are unsteady or slightly afraid need to be supportive, but take a secondary role and do not do anything to sabotage what the strong among us might decide to put into play. Many who are weak now will develop more confidence as they get a better understanding of the dynamics of these types of processes. So deferring to others is a stage all of us must experience at one time or another. The bottom line is this: whether you are actively involved as a New African or not, don't do anything that harms other New Africans and their Black nationalist initiative. Getting something serious done is often more a herky-jerky and muddled process than a smooth one. So don't be surprised or get discouraged when you experience or see others experience some serious turbulence, because the times are few when turbulence keeps the airplane from reaching its destination. Turbulence, ups and downs, back and forth, all are part of the process. Don't assign it more or less weight than it deserves. Recently, almost 100 years ago, in 1921, things got way out of control in the Greenwood section of Tulsa, Oklahoma. The Greenwood section is where all of the Black people, or New Africans, live, and they suffered because they, like Black people throughout the United States, had developed a comfort zone with being between a rock and a hard place. One thing we have to start doing before we can take control of our destiny is to interpret events from the perspective of people who want to control their destiny. We have to assess every event in terms of what we did or failed to do, and only address what outsiders did in order to increase our understanding of what we must do. We are not napkins in the wind, and we have to stop framing ourselves as victims of a superior power. We ourselves are a power, and we need to take on the responsibilities and consequences, sometimes fortunate, sometimes unfortunate, that accompany those who possess power. New Africans in Greenwood knew John and Jane Doe very well. There was no reason to assume anything good about them, and many reasons to conclude that they could always go lower than they had ever gone before. And the New Africans in Greenwood, knowing that, should have kept that at the top of their list of concerns and made some plans that would mitigate the damage in case of an outbreak. but they did not. And when a confrontation took place, new Africans suffered disproportionately, much more than they should have. There was a race war in Tulsa in 1921, and under the circumstances, it was a war the new Africans had little chance of winning. They had little chance of winning because they tried to make do in a political context that denied Black people any legitimate authority. They had little chance of winning because the battle took place in the neighborhood where they lived, not in the neighborhood where John and Jane Doe lived. And they had little chance of winning because they had not prepared for an outbreak as well as they should have prepared. As far as the number of actual fighters was concerned, the Blacks were outnumbered probably as much as 25 or 30 to 1. But that wasn't one of the reasons they had little chance of winning. As far as the amount of weapons and ammunition is concerned, the same applies. Let's take a brief look so that we can understand in the year 2020 how the three former mentioned factors handicapped us to no end in 1921 in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Number one, the new Africans in Greenwood tried to make do in a political context that denied Black people any legitimate authority. Authority determines what is right and what is wrong. Authority determines what is legal and what is criminal. The lack of authority guaranteed that if John and Jane Doe, the mob participants, didn't get the job done, then John and Jane Doe, the public officials, would. It was the lack of authority, the lack of legitimacy, the lack of sovereignty that doomed the new Africans to an unfortunate outcome. Within that context, to fight back was a criminal act. If they had fought back and won, they would have been persecuted by John and Jane Doe's legal system. And if they had fought back and been overwhelmed, as they did, they would be murdered, maimed, robbed, humiliated, charged with carrying out criminal activities, and persecuted. Some of them chose to fight even if overwhelmed, which, in my opinion, was the correct choice to make. Greenwood's new Africans fell into the habit of making do when they were between a rock and a hard place. Was it their fault that they were between a rock and a hard place? That is debatable, and in the year 2020, somewhat irrelevant. The fact of the matter is that they were there and they slumbered into a make-do approach to dealing with it. That is the psychology of the roach in the kitchen after the lights go out, trying to make a way without drawing the attention of the Bigfoot and scampering frantically if the light comes on and the Bigfoot enters the room. That's not a good situation to make do with. Number two, the fighting was taking place in the neighborhood the new Africans lived in. I could make the case that the new Africans didn't own the neighborhood, they just lived there. But that's a different issue than what I am talking about at this time. Where the fighting took place is important because in this particular occurrence, it allowed John and Jane Doe to use weapons that the new Africans did not dare use. John and Jane Doe could burn the neighborhood down, thereby destroying buildings and structures that served as cover for many Black fighters and diminishing their power to defend themselves. Hidden factors like that can come into play have to be brought to the light and planned for before the next outbreak occurs. Of course, since Blacks were not expecting that type of outbreak at that particular time, they did not have the opportunity to slant the result in their favor. The new Africans of Greenwood did not start that fight and were therefore unable to dictate the early terms of the battle. But based on the knowledge that John and Jane Doe can always go lower than they have ever gone before, The blacks of Greenwood should have known to expect the worst and should have been better prepared for such an outbreak or something similar to it. And this brings us to the most damaging reason why the blacks in Tulsa had little chance of winning once a racial outbreak erupted. The black people in Greenwood, Oklahoma, and the rest of the United States of America developed a comfort zone with making do, and instead of taking as much of their destiny into their own hands as they could, they took the easy way out and hoped everything would be all right. The easy way out is often the cowardly way into a lot of bad results, and New Africans suffered the consequences then. New Africans are going to suffer those consequences again if we don't stir ourselves out of our make-do slumber and start organizing to defend ourselves from modern-day military-like attacks by John and Jane Doe. Everything is not going to be all right, so we need to get away from that way of surrendering our fate to those who despise us. The only thing that's going to be all right is what we make all right. But for everything to have been all right for blacks in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in June of 1921, more New Africans had to have taken on the role of a warrior. And that did not happen. There were some warriors among those New Africans in Tulsa, Oklahoma, in 1921. And I can imagine they wanted to prepare for an outbreak, but could not get enough New Africans to help them establish a defense force to deal with outsiders who came to Greenwood with bad intentions. These warriors probably approached New Africans and were told they were overreacting, were going to cause trouble, or that each man was going to be able to defend his own home. Those who responded like that were just too irresponsible to form part of a militia of several hundred to a thousand of black minutemen. As a result, the New African warriors could only rely on about 100 men, 150 at most, to play a part in resisting an invading force of racists. In 1921, there were more than 10,000 New Africans living in Tulsa. And of those, there had to be at least 2,000 able-bodied men. On the morning of June 1, 1921, 5,000 John Does attacked Greenwood,
and the 150 or so
New African warriors put up one hell of a fight. But the destiny of the New African women and children fell in the hands of the 2,000 men who had refused to join the New African warriors and help them prepare a defense force for Greenwood. If only 250 additional New Africans had prepared to fight, it probably would not have resulted in victory for the New Africans, but it would have slowed down the advance of the invaders and bought additional time, maybe only an hour or a half hour, but enough time to have allowed the women and children to escape the danger zone and reach safe haven. With just the 150 or fewer New Africans who went to war, the invaders didn't have enough firepower to overwhelm them and were forced to resort to extraordinary measures to gain the upper hand. So it wasn't numbers nor lack of weapons that doomed Greenwood to its fate. With 250 more black warriors, John and Jane Doe might have even gone into retreat for a while. Might have. But what is certain is that there would have been extra time bought for the women and children, those who were least capable of defending themselves, to get away before the mob got to where they were. The fight was taking place where the New Africans lived, so the mobsters could burn the neighborhood down without a worry and force the black warriors to expose themselves and go into retreat mode. After that, the rout was on. New Africans had refused to take the time to prepare, and as a consequence, the rout was on. Smart is what you do, not what you know. The Blacks in Greenwood knew how low John and Jane Doe could go, but they refused to do anything with that knowledge. And now we are 100 years away from yesterday, and tomorrow is on the way. And make no doubt about it, tomorrow is going to get here. Prepare yourself. You'd better prepare, because knowledge has never saved anyone. In the early 1990s, I wrote a book called Not to Be. The book is also published under the title Dissecting Integration. Two names, but the same book, the same material. Anyway, in the first essay, I wrote a little bit about poor white trash. The essence of what I said is that poor white trash is not in the hills of Tennessee, the dirt towns of the South, or at the bottom of white America's social pyramid. It is at the top of white America's social pyramid and is composed of state and federal legislators and congressmen, presidents, chairpersons, and major stockholders of America's most profitable businesses, controllers of America's media, members of America's most acclaimed societies, socialites, etc. In short, America's white trash, all of whom are spiritually bankrupt, is in control of the United States of America. And as for John and Jane Doe, I mentioned them in the same essay. They have been led to a state of disconnectedness from most of the people in the world, suffer from a superiority complex, which is a disease that infects ignorant people, and they are uninformed but willing parties to the immoral activities carried out by their low-life elites and political leaders. I wrote that in the early 1990s, but it could have been in the early 1890s or the early 1790s, because from the very beginning, the United States of America has been under the control of poor white trash, and United Statesers, particularly the white ones, carry the stamp, immoral countenance, and stench of poor white trash. So you, brother, and you, sister, need to be careful when it comes to who you allow yourself to be identified with. It says more about you than you might ever imagine. You would probably be surprised how often people make a statement without being aware of the subliminal messages that it conveys. Reach into your wallet or purse and take a look at those green dollar bills you crave so much. Isn't it telling that you can absolutely adore one of the biggest symbols of black humiliation, exploitation, and degradation? Look at those bills. They scream white superiority and black inferiority so loud, so unapologetically. But most blacks are so detached from themselves that something as obvious as that doesn't even occur to them. I bet that if a picture of a lynching was somewhere on those bills, most blacks would convince themselves that it really doesn't make all that much difference. When something is accorded as much value as money, it needs to say something positive and uplifting about you. The black dollar, the medium of exchange that will drive an independent black economy, will do just that. It has already been designed and can readily be put into use, but we need to put a lot of related work in before we can turn it loose. The black dollar is one symbol of pride that will serve us well, but if we don't work on developing an independent black economy that revolves around it, the black dollar will be just another valuable resource that we simply let go to waste. We just keep on wasting so many of our valuable assets and resources and wasting opportunities to uplift ourselves because we keep on wanting to stay attached to John and Jane Doe. John and Jane Doe are a burden for new Africans, not a blessing. They handicap us. They do not make it easier for us. They are big-time liabilities, both short and long-term. Thinking in terms of a black economy that functions as an independent organism proves to ourselves that we are finally on the road to becoming all that we can be, and we can start contributing to a new balance of world power that has been emerging for the last 50 or so years. Interacting with John and Jane Doe in the manner we do assures that we have little chance of ever doing anything worthwhile. Accepting the roles that leave John and Jane Doe feeling at ease makes monumental achievements an impossibility for us. John and Jane Doe have us thinking that being able to buy expensive champagne is an achievement. Becoming a famous athlete or entertainer is an achievement. Earning millions of dollars in the serve and entertain employment categories is an achievement. Being hired to a management position by a Fortune 500 corporation is an achievement. graduating as valedictorian in a traditionally white college or university is an achievement, etc. We consider those type things as important accomplishments because in order to identify with John and Jane Doe on their terms, we have to play the role of mental pygmies. Mental pygmies don't concern themselves with achieving anything monumental. In fact, they can't even imagine what a monumental achievement is. They are more concerned about petty objectives than substantial ones. They have become so concerned with acquiring material and ideological bling-bling that, as I just said, they can't even imagine what a monumental achievement is. Even if some persons in other parts of the world admire a particular African-American's accomplishments, they cannot assign them value because African-Americans never accomplish anything outside of a John and Jane Doe context. Tonto is never going to get the respect the Long Ranger gets, even if he saves the Long Ranger's life every episode. That's just the way it is. I can't think of a single group of people that had the spending power that African Americans have had that never developed a bourgeoisie political sector. It has been normal for those who battle to achieve a comfortable economic setting to fix their sight on taking control of the political reins or gain control of many of those who control the political reins. But African Americans never have sought to take control, to break away from being characterized as John and Jane Doe's Tonto. Is it that those blacks hold many of the same prejudices against black people that John and Jane Doe manifest all of the time? Or is it because they know they rely on John and Jane Doe for their standard of living? I suspect that one of the reasons is because the amount of spending they do is disproportionately high compared to their ownership stake in the economy. African Americans' ownership of what the economy produces is all but non-existent, so they don't have status and they know it. If those circumstances continue to rule the day, you will never have any status either. Remember, how you identify yourself is serious business, and how other people view you is affected by whether they see you as an independent actor or somebody else's appendage. You have the opportunity to achieve something that will make you a major player and recipient of some big-time props. Identify yourself as a new African. Study and learn enough to found or become part of an independent black town or territory, and contribute to the establishment of an independent black economic order that is symbolized by a unique independent black dollar. Those are the types of achievements black people in the United States can be proud of, need to be talking about, and need to be adding to the mix. I'll be talking about each of them in greater detail during the course of these broadcasts. Don't forget, you can contact me from my website at www.asetbooks.com. www.asetbooks.com. And there you can find much more information on this subject. I will be presenting the next broadcast next week, same day, same hour. Remember, we are black people. We are not dark-skinned white people. We need a nation of our own. Peace be with you, brothers and sisters, if you are willing to do what is necessary to get it.